This is Sequitur, an exploration of the natural consequences of our actions at the individual, community, cultural, and species levels. Sequitur is brought to you by Expressions of Peace, personal, powerful, and heart-to-heart. I'm Susan Livingston, your host and producer. Sequitur is archived under the Expressions of Peace tab at panina.org. That's P-A-N-I-N-A, as in peace and nonviolence in action. Sequitur, the theme song, is by Zymphd. That's Z-Y-M-P-H-T. You can find more of his music on SoundCloud. Sequitur, it follows. Sequitur began production in April 2016 to provide extreme weather coverage and climate disruption updates while Extinction Radio was on hiatus. Inspired by Guy McPherson's Nature Bats Last, the focus of Sequitur expanded to consider the overarching issue of habitat loss. Sequitur's content further expanded under the influence of Derek Jensen's book, The Myth of Human Supremacy, to cover extinction events and their drivers for the whole web of life rather than only property destruction and loss of human life or monetized livelihood. The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History by Elizabeth Colbert and Columbus and Other Cannibals by Indigenous historian Jack D. Forbes have provided additional conceptual underpinnings. Aho, Metakwe Owasan, we are all related.
Hee-haw! Hello, everybody. It's Benjamin the Donkey.
Hi, Benji. I'm glad to see you. What have you got for us today?
The Ant and the Grasshopper. The ant counseled food preservation, but the grasshopper chose celebration. When global starvation kindled conflagration, they both got a burning sensation. Hee-haw!
You know, for a guy who doesn't look like he's ever gone hungry, you sure do worry about food a lot.
You know, we've only one way to pig out. Tell everyone you've got a shout. From high rise and steeple, Soylent Green is people, and that's what our future's about. Hee-haw!
So that's what you're worried about. Well, I'm more concerned about the privatization of water. That's why I've been following the water protectors, both with the pipeline resistance movement in Turtle Island and the mining resistance movement in Heart Island. Whether in Amazonia or at Standing Rock, indigenous people understand that water is life. And I would add that money is not life. I read the New Confessions of an Economic Hitman published early last year, at about the same time as I hosted a remote viewing of the 20th anniversary celebration and fundraiser dinner of the Pachamama Alliance. The original Confessions of an Economic Hitman, published a decade earlier, spent 70 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list and has been translated into more than 30 languages. I was eager to interview the author of that book, also the co-founder of that organization, who did all of the translation during that event, about his shamanic awakening in the Amazon and the possibility of a shamanic response to the exploitation of the mineral resources of the Amazon headwaters. But 15 June, 2 hours before my brother would collect me for the 90-minute drive to the train station to embark upon my recent 9-day journey, was the soonest he could be available. So I secured the John Perkins interview on my hard drive with the intention of producing the show immediately upon my return and left my dear listeners with Sequitur Food Share, released the day after I arrived at my ultimate destination in northwestern Illinois for a family event. Today, I'm proud to present Sequitur Perception, featuring an interview with John Perkins. I will introduce John Perkins with language from his Amazon profile. John Perkins advises corporations, executives, and entrepreneurs on ways to make the transition from a death economy, exploiting resources that are declining at accelerating rates, to a life economy, cleaning up pollution, recycling, and other technologies that create lifestyles millennials want to inherit. John has lived four lives. as an economic hitman, as the CEO of a successful alternative energy company who was rewarded for not disclosing his economic hitman past, as an expert on indigenous cultures and shamanism, a teacher and writer who used this expertise to promote ecology and sustainability while continuing to honor his vow of silence about his life as an economic hitman, and as a writer who, in telling the real-life story about his extraordinary dealings, has exposed the world of international intrigue and corruption that is turning the American Republic into a global empire despised by increasing numbers of people around the planet. And now, the interview.
Thank you so much for the new Confessions of an Economic Hitman. I consider that the ultimate whistleblower book. To actually have that firsthand account from somebody that was there and doing it, it absolutely rocked my world.
Well, thanks. That's nice to hear.
Quite a piece of work. I've also been studying a bit of Peruvian shamanism myself, so I was really interested in your experience in the Amazon with shamans there. You said a little about it in the book. And I'd like to hear in more detail where you've been in the past 3 months, 6 months, whatever.
Well, I traveled around a lot teaching. And in the last 6 months, I've been to, where have I been? The Amazon, Ecuadorian Amazon, the Andes, Guatemala, all over Guatemala with the Mayan people, Colombia with the Kogi people up in the Sierra Nevada, Costa Rica twice teaching there at two different venues. The Bahamas, teaching at a Hindu ashram there, which is quite fascinating. I speak there every year. At events in Los Angeles and San Francisco, Writers Conference. And next week, I'm headed to St. Petersburg, Russia, then to Astana, Kazakhstan, where I'm speaking at events, and then to Italy. So it's a very full life.
Ma'am.
I'm blessed. I'm blessed to have the opportunity to speak to such a variety of people all over the world.
I want to kind of focus on Central and South America, what we're calling Heart Island and Serpent Island in indigenous parlance these days since Standing Rock. We've been looking up to the Ecuadorian government as a model for codifying the rights of nature into law on the one hand. And then on the other hand, I'm looking at news items about the government basically putting whole villages on lockdown and selling out to the Chinese. And I'd like to hear what you have to say about that.
Yeah, it's a very mixed bag. It's an interesting situation. And right now, the Shuar people in an area where I lived as a Peace Corps volunteer is really under attack by a gold mining company. It's a Canadian-Chinese endeavor. We like to blame the Chinese, but it's the American oil companies that caused the problems originally. Now it's the Chinese and the Canadians and American companies are still involved. Rafael Correa, the new president, has just been elected, and he came in 8 years ago. And before him, there had been, I think I have this right, 8 presidents in 10 years. So Ecuador has a history of coups and counter-coups and great instability. Well, Correa brought stability. Correa has a PhD in economics from the University of Illinois. He's married to a Belgian woman, where he got his master's degree in Belgium. He speaks many languages, including Quechua, the indigenous language of the Andes. He's a real Renaissance man. And he came into power, a very strong advocate of environmentalism and protecting the Amazon. But that's changed. And it's hard to know exactly what's happened, but I can give you a couple of my own opinions, if you'd like.
Yes.
Opinions that are based on a lot of experience.
First-hand observation. That's exactly why I wanted to talk to you.
Well, first of all, the Andes and coast of Ecuador are some of the most densely populated areas in Latin America. But a third of the country is the Amazon Basin area, and that's one of the least populated places in Latin America. It's also the place in Ecuador that has the most resources, mineral resources, gold and oil. Mm-hmm. So Ecuadorian people from all walks of life, well-educated ones and illiterate ones alike who live on the coast in the Andes, constantly put pressure on the government, on Correa, to exploit the resources in the Amazon area. They say, there's nobody lives there, which of course isn't true, but as a percentage, it almost looks like nobody. And if you fly over it, you go through vast areas of uninhabited jungle. Of course, these are areas where the people who live there are hunters and gatherers. Hunters and gatherers need very large territories, so it isn't as it appears. But nonetheless, the people of Ecuador put tremendous pressure on Correa to exploit the oil and the gold and other resources in that area that's so precious as a world resource, the sacred upper Amazon, the sacred waters of the Amazon. It's where it all begins, and it's an amazingly diverse and important part of our global ecosystem. Now, a second thing happened in that Correa had a lot of pressure put on him by people with jobs like I used to have as an economic hitman. People from the United States, from China, people from Russia, from other parts of the world to exploit these resources, and individuals from the oil companies and the mining companies. So he was getting pressure from both sides, his own people who live in these highly populated areas and international corporations and governments. And then in 2009, the democratically elected president of Honduras, Manuel Zelaya, was overthrown in a CIA-sponsored coup. Because he stood up to Chiquita and Dole and some of the other big American corporations that work in that country, he implemented a land reform policy that they didn't like, and he also increased the minimum wage significantly, which they didn't like at all. Mm-hmm. And he was overthrown in a coup. And Correa at the time said, "Well, my gosh, you know, I'll probably be next, because this is what happens when you stand up to these corporations." And sure enough, within a number of months after that, there was a coup launched against Correa in Ecuador. Now, I have every reason to believe that it was a CIA-sponsored coup like the one in Honduras. It wasn't as by the books, and I think it was meant to fail. It did fail. The reason I think it was meant to fail is because it was spearheaded by the chief of police of Quito, Ecuador, capital city, who graduated from the School of the Americas, like the guy who spearheaded the one in Honduras and so many others. But the army opposed the coup. And in fact, there was battles in the streets of Quito between the army and the police. And the army wanted to reinstate Correa, and the police wanted to overthrow him. And the CIA very well knows that no coup in Latin America has ever succeeded when the army opposed it, the local army. You've got to get them on your side. The police of Quito are nothing compared to the national military. And so I think it was a shot across the bow. I think there was a message being sent to Correa: you better play the game, or else you'll go the same way as Zelaya in Honduras and Roldos in Ecuador in the 70s and Allende and so many other heads of state who defied U.S. policies and corporations and been overthrown, as I talk about in my book. I think there was a shot across the bow. And so Correa at that point is saying what I think I would have said to myself: I can either stay in office and deal with the situation and let the oil companies and the mining companies do what the majority of my people want them to do and go against my desire to be a better environmentalist, or I can get overthrown or killed and replaced by somebody who then is going to be a puppet of the corporatocracy. I don't have any evidence of this, any absolute proof. But I suspect that's the position he's in. And, you know, he's waved around my book, The Original Confessions of an Economic Hitman. He wrote an endorsement for my next book. He's waved this book around and said, "Yeah, we've got economic hitmen here in Jackals. We know. I've experienced the same thing." And here it comes. So I think what's happened in Ecuador, Susan, is this man has been put under tremendous pressure from so many areas, and he's given in. And it also appears that in the last year or so, there's been tremendous corruption in his government. And I don't know what that's all about, whether he just sort of gave up and let that happen, or whether he figured that he's got to get what he can while he can. I don't know the story behind that. But what I do think I know is the story behind a lot of his reversal in policy that's tied in with the story behind the story, which, of course, I personally was so deeply involved in my previous life as an economic hitman.
So if there's such an overwhelming majority interested in exploiting the Amazon headwaters, how did they ever get that clause passed in their new constitution to begin with?
Well, it was a huge effort. And I'm a co-founder of the Pachamama Alliance with Bill and Lynn Twist. I'm also a founder of Dream Change, which has an amazing conference coming up called the Love Summit. And Dream Change was founded before Pachamama Alliance and really was the foundation for what has come since with Pachamama Alliance. At the beginning of Correa's presidency, roughly a decade ago, we saw the opportunity of Pachamama Alliance to change that constitution, and Correa seemed very much in favor of it. However, he had no budget to do that, and so the Pachamama Alliance provided a lot of money to hire lawyers. We wanted to bring in internationally recognized lawyers from Harvard and other places to forge a new constitution that could be a model for other countries, not just applicable in Ecuador, but we wanted to be global and international. So we invested a lot of money, donated a lot of money, really, to the country to bring in these people. Bill Twist, co-founder of Pachamama, put together quite a team to make this happen. And I think Correa was in favor of this. I think Correa saw the value of protecting his lands at the time. And then subsequently, he's come under tremendous pressure. So the Constitution remains, but the teeth are not there to really enforce it.
It's as toothless as I am. It's really sad. You know, we talk a lot about the rule of law and personhood.
But, you know, when you think about it, I mean, it's really similar in a way to what's happening in this country, that we had, you know, Obama had all these executive orders to create land trusts and set aside land, and now...
change in administration, the whole thing gets flipped. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's very, very easy for people in power to move forward and do what they think they want to do, especially if they've got majority backing them. So in the case of Ecuador, the majority of the people, a great many people, support exploiting the Amazon, and some of the most wealthy people in the country do. And we find the same thing here, that an awful lot of the big corporations and the more powerful, wealthy people in this country want less regulations. They want deregulation. They want Wall Street deregulated, the banks deregulated, and so on and so forth. So it's, you know, what does the rule of law mean? All of this brings into question, what does it mean to be a democracy?
And it brings into question your original claim about the consciousness shift that you say is underway. Yeah, I believe all things exist in balance. And what we're seeing is a widening of the extremes around that central fulcrum.
I think we're seeing a reaction. Maybe this is just my hope, but it's also my belief that there is a progressive movement around the world that's going up to an understanding that we're living on a very fragile space station. And there aren't any shuttles. You can't get off. I can't get off. My grandson, who's 9 years old, won't be able to get off. You know, maybe a few people will get off and go to Mars or the moon or someplace, but that's going to be very few, and it's not a solution.
And they're not going to have any kind of lifestyle at all.
No. But we're on this fragile space station, and we've been navigating it to disaster. And I think people are waking up to the fact that we've got to change that. Now, when that happens, a reaction sets in, is that any time when revolutionary ideas come up, I mean, you know, when the idea of the American Revolution first started to emerge, everybody, it was a very strong reaction. There's no way we can stand up to the British Empire, and we don't want to. You know, the king is sovereign, and the Americas too. You had a tremendous reaction against going to war with England. And in every revolution that there is, you get this very strong reaction at the beginning. And I think that's what we're experiencing now here and in Europe and in China and in Russia and all over Latin America and Africa. All over the world, we're experiencing this awakening. And at the same time, then there's a reaction. The status quo doesn't want an awakening.
And the status quo has the resources and the money and the numbers.
And let's not forget that we're all part of the status quo in a way.
Absolutely.
You know, the fact that we're talking on this piece of equipment and you're sitting in a nice house somewhere, and so am I, means that we're living decent lives. We've got plenty to eat and we get a roof over our heads. And it's hard to get really motivated to rock the boat, to be a revolutionary. If they'd lost the revolution, Washington would have been hanged, and so would the other founders, and most of them, a lot of them at least, were very prosperous individuals. They would have lost their lives and their lands and their children and would have lost their inheritance. They were taking big risks, and we're kind of at times like this again. That doesn't maybe seem quite as radical to us, but maybe it is.
I think it's far more radical.
I
think we have a lot more to lose.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think that all of these wonderful things that are going on are just too little too late. Not that we shouldn't do what we know is right, regardless of the outcome, but I don't see pursuing a universal consciousness transformation as a feasible goal.
Imagine all people as one, whose food has run out, so there's none. Although you may deem this dream too extreme, we soon will be all dead and done. Hee-haw!
I got a lot of emails from people, a tremendous number of emails from people. Every day I get a few, and over the years since Confessions of an Economic Hitman came out about 12 or 13 years ago, and now the new Confessions, I get a lot of people saying how much that's inspired them. And, you know, I'm teaching a writer's webinar that's coming up in a couple of weeks. It's a four-part series on how to write a bestseller as an activist. It's a small salon. It's restricted to 24 people, so we can really come together. But I think writing, I think what you do, I think the media, I think this is an amazing time for all of us. And in a way, it's easier to get the message out today than it's ever been before with the internet, with what we're doing here.
It's magic, isn't it?
It is magic. And let's not forget that the American Revolution really happened because Tom Paine wrote Common Sense and The Crisis, and Franklin and Jefferson and others wrote pamphlets. The written word, it was the word that really inspired people. And it's the word today. And I think it's one of the reasons that Trump likes to throw so much confusion into things with tweets and so forth and deny what his own press secretary says. And because he realizes that if he can undermine the credibility of the word, if he can undermine the credibility of Twitter and Facebook and all the other media outlets out there, and he can keep spreading this word of fake news, if he can undermine what you and I do, then he's won and become extremely powerful. And I think we have to guard against that. Let the world know that that's not going to work. We're going to maintain the power that we have through the written and the spoken word and the visual word now. If people are interested, there's a couple of spaces left in that Writers Conference for Activists, and they should go to johnperkins.org. While they're at johnperkins.org, sign up for my newsletter that comes out about once a month.
We interrupt this interview to bring you an urgent update from the Pipeline Resistance Movement. The Intercept documented security contracting by Energy Transfer Partners to surveil, infiltrate, and undermine Dakota Access Pipeline protesters in North Dakota and all along the controversial pipeline's route, according to a report by the Dakota Free Press dated May 31st. The leaked documents also show local, state, and federal agencies coordinating their law enforcement effort with these private hired guns from Tiger Swan, a security contractor along the same paramilitary lines as Blackwater. The Dakota Free Press points out that this corporate fascism began under the Obama administration. According to The Intercept, Tiger Swan gathered drone video surveillance and other evidence to aid law enforcement with arrests and prosecutions, expressed frustration when law enforcement gave protesters leeway, and pushed for quote-unquote more punitive tactics like quicker arrests and fines and higher bail. The Intercept reports that Tiger Swan referred to pipeline protests as insurgencies and attacks. The documents revealed, quote, a widespread and sustained campaign of infiltration of protest camps and activist circles. Tiger Swan agents using false names and identities regularly sought to obtain the trust of protesters, which they used to gather information they reported back to their employer. In an October 3rd report, Tiger Swan discusses how to use its knowledge of internal camp dynamics, quote, exploitation of ongoing native versus non-native rifts and tribal rifts between peaceful and violent elements is critical in our efforts to delegitimize the anti-DAPL movement, end embedded quote. On February 19th, Tiger Swan makes explicit its plans to infiltrate a Chicago protest group. Quote, Tiger Swan collections teams will make contact with event organizers to embed within the structure of the demonstration to develop a trusted agent status to be cultivated for future collection efforts. Close embedded quote. The report notes, later repeating its intent to, quote, covertly make contact with event organizers. End embedded quote. And close quote. Tiger Swan ascribed to Energy Transfer Partners' opponents, quote-unquote, a strong religious component and a jihadist insurgency model. In a September 22nd situation report to Energy Transfer Partners, Tiger Swan pointed out the presence at a Mandan, South Dakota protest of Palestinian activist Haitham El-Sabri of Austin, Texas, and three additional Palestinians from California who are allegedly associated with the Palestinian youth movement and raised concerns about, quote, the movement's involvement with Islamic individuals. The presence of additional Palestinians in the camp and the movement's involvement with Islamic individuals is a dynamic that requires further investigation. Currently, there is no information to suggest terrorist-type tactics or operations. However, with the current limitation on information flow out of the camp, it cannot be ruled out. Close quote. Say what? Tiger Swan's summary report mourns that, quote, social media continues to give little indication or warning of planned protests or locations. The protester security is actively patrolling local highways and pipeline work areas in search of DAPL employees, close quote. In a stunning example of the pot calling the kettle black, they identified the Red Warrior Tribal Security Forces as the security arm of the movement and reported that they, quote, demonstrated military and law enforcement tactics, close quote. Tiger Swan also appears to have lied to the state of North Dakota when they claimed that they were, quote, doing management and IT consulting for our client and doing no security work, close quote. When the North Dakota Private Investigation and Security Board learned about the company's position as a Dakota Access contractor, they wrote a letter to its North Carolina headquarters requesting that it submit a license application, which they finally did. The board denied the application on December 19. Predictably, Tiger Swan appealed the decision. The board responded to the appeal on January 10th with concern about Tiger Swan's lack of transparency and responsiveness to that point. But, nod, nod, wink, wink, before the end of the month, the entire project had been fast-tracked. Today, neither Tiger Swan nor the board is responding to questions regarding the current status of the company's license. So much for the rule of law. According to the Dakota Free Press, quote, the intercept documents run through May, showing that even after the clearing out of the Standing Rock protest camp and the completion of pipeline construction, Tiger Swan protects its profitable contract by playing up threats to Energy Transfer Partners' assets. Such is one of the dangers of these mercenary firms. Their profit motive may drive them to encourage clients to believe they are in a constant state of war. This should sound familiar. And continue investing in private police state efforts that infringe on citizens' civil liberties. Close quote. I'm quoting extensively because I don't want my questioning of the consciousness shift observed and reported by John Perkins to seem contrarian in nature. I can't make this stuff up. I'm just more than a little surprised that someone of his background as an economic hitman, someone of his stature as a shaman among indigenous people, would be in such complete denial about the shadow side of the consciousness shift.
You are listening to Sequitur, a production of Expressions of Peace, personal, powerful, and heart-to-heart. Sequitur is archived at panina.org, that's P-A-N-I-N-A, as in Peace and Nonviolence in Action.
We probably want to shift gears into your relationship with the indigenous people of the Amazon rainforest and your studies in shamanism. Mostly what I want to focus on is when you go back 3 months ago or 2 months ago, whenever you were down there with the people, what's that reunion like for you, and what does your current practice look like?
Well, thank you. Yeah. So every year I take groups of people, not more than 17 or so, in December to the Kogi indigenous people, amazing people in the Sierra Nevada mountains of Colombia on the Caribbean coast, beautiful area, incredible area. And then in January to the Mayan people of Guatemala, to their sacred sites. And we hang out with the shamans, men and women shamans, and we do amazing ceremonies and go deep into this stuff. And in August with the Pachamama Alliance into the Amazon and Andes. And I just did another trip with a group of people from Baylor Medical Center into the Amazon and Andes about 2 months ago. And for myself, all of this started back in the late 60s when I was a Peace Corps volunteer I joined the Peace Corps because I didn't believe in the Vietnam War.
Right.
And the Peace Corps offered the possibility of draft deferment, and I was able to get a draft deferment primarily because I came from a community area in New Hampshire where there's a lot of rednecks, and they all volunteered to fight. You know, they all wanted to go and get rid of communism, and so my draft board didn't really need me, fortunately. But they would have drafted me if I hadn't done something. So I joined the Peace Corps. Peace Corps sent me to 8 weeks of training in Southern California to learn Spanish and about credit and savings co-ops first. You know, 8 weeks, you don't learn a hell of a lot. But once I lived there, I got better at it. So now I'm fluent, but it took a while.
Also fluent in Quechua?
No. Both of those languages, I spoke some when I lived with those people, but they were very difficult languages and very, very easy to make some very embarrassing mistakes. Intonation. I got up one morning and I thought I was saying to the woman of the house, you know, good morning, you're looking very good this morning. And everybody kind of gave me this horrified look and then they burst into laughter. Fortunately, they were very understanding because what I'd actually said to her is, good morning, your ass looks very nice this morning. And about that time, I figured, well, the man of the house speaks Spanish. Maybe I better speak Spanish.
Yeah.
So just a matter of inflection of the words. It's everything. It's the same words. I mean, it's a matter of inflection. It's whether you're looking good or your butt's looking good, you know? Anyhow, so while I was living in the Amazon with the Shwa, they are hunters and gatherers. So it's what we would call a primitive life, but I'd call it a very natural life, a very wonderful life, really.
Yeah.
But I got very sick and I was dying. I couldn't keep any food down. I lost a lot of weight in a short period of time. And I was a 2-day walk through dense jungle to the nearest dirt road, where if I could find one of those rickety old wooden buses, I would have to take another 2 days on this rickety, awful old bus to get to the nearest medical facility. There was no way this was going to happen. I couldn't keep any food down. I was extremely sick. So I was resigned to dying. And late one afternoon, one of the guys who spoke English, the school teacher, there weren't too many in that community that did, but he comes up to me with this old Shwa man, tiny guy, very short. He says to me, this man's the shaman. He can heal you. And I'm like, well, what's a shaman? You know, this is 1969. I'd never heard of a shaman, really. I'd heard of witch doctors. You know, that's what the movies called them in those days. Anyway, the idea that maybe he could cure me got my attention. So this guy looks me up and down from my feet to my head and back and reads my energy. Now I know what he was doing. I didn't have any idea at that point what he was doing. He looks up at me very seriously, like he's going to say something profound. He says to me, you're dying. I'm like, oh, yeah, no, who clued you, Dick Tracy, you know?
Yeah, right.
And he says, and that's good. Well, later I would learn why he thought it was good was because the Shwa believe in reincarnation, and he thought my life was about as bad as it could get. Here's a guy that doesn't know how to shoot a blowgun, can't track a jaguar. What's he doing in this jungle anyway? Is he sick? He's not going to make it. I think I started crying at that point. I was really desperate. He looks at me, the shaman, and he says, well, maybe you're not ready to die, in which case I could heal you tonight. And he said, I think I'll take that. So that night, he takes me on a classic shamanic journey. And we, on our trips, we take people when we're in Colombia or Guatemala, or the Amazon. There's many different ways of doing it. Some people use these plants like ayahuasca. The Mayans use fire ceremonies. The Kogi of Colombia, they use something called pagamentos, payments to the earth, where you get that, you pay the earth. You give things back to the earth, and you feel this incredible ecstatic experience. They're shamanic journeys, however you induce them. So I went on the shamanic journey that night, and I saw that I'd grown up in rural New Hampshire. My family goes back to the 1600s in that area. We were very hygienic, wash your hands a lot, ate very mild, bland foods. Suddenly, I'm living with people that have never seen a bar of soap, and they're eating very, very strange foods. Like, they don't drink water in the Amazon because the rivers all have organic matter in them, you know?
Right, right. It's fermented.
Yes, the women make something called chicha, which is, they chew manioc root and spit it.
Yep.
And it ferments into a kind of beer that they can then mix water with. It's alcohol. And you have to drink a lot of it because you got to rehydrate a lot in the tropics. So I'm drinking a lot of chicha and I'm eating a lot of squirming white grubs and other strange foods. It seems strange to me. And I'm realizing on this shamanic journey, what I'm seeing is that as I'm doing that, my there's a voice coming over my shoulder saying, it'll kill you. A voice from my past, from my childhood, from growing up in New England. It'll kill you. And at the same time, I'm seeing how incredibly healthy the Shwa are. Men are built like Tarzan. The women, I was in my early 20s, the women were looking very good. And people live to be very, very old if they don't die in a hunting accident or a dugout canoe tipping over. It's not so much disease unless some foreigners bring it in, but accidents. Mm-hmm. So anyway, a lot of people live to be very old. So that night on that shamanic journey, I saw that it wasn't the food or drink that was killing me. It was my mindset, my perception of reality. It wasn't the reality. It was the perception of reality, because the reality was chicha and food that I thought was strange. My perception was they were killing me. So my new reality was they were killing me. Once I turned that around and created a new reality that, oh my gosh, these things make these people healthy. Maybe they'll make me healthy. I created a new reality. Same reality one, same food, same chicha. Now I change my perception and I go to a new reality number two, which is I get healthy. And I did. Next day, I'm fine. And the shaman came by a couple of days later and he said, you know, you're healthy. You owe me. And his requirement, his payment was that I become his apprentice.
Uh-huh.
You know, I ended up spending 2 years with these people. Now, 1969, there was no future in shamanism. Nobody ever even heard of it in the United States. I'd come out of business because the last thing in the world I wanted to do was become a shaman's apprentice. Today, there's a great future and a lot of people would cut off their right arm to become a shaman, but the guy saved my life. So I became his apprentice, and it was not an easy apprenticeship. It's a rigorous experience, but it changed my life, and I learned a lot. And later, I became apprentices with shamans in Iran and Egypt and Indonesia and all over Latin America and a lot of different places. And what I kept learning is everywhere you go, it's all about perception. And then when you come right down to it, Susan, psychotherapy is all about perception. Quantum physics is all about perception. Everything's all about perception, you know. Right now, there's an objective reality. These microphones we're talking through, that's objective reality. But the words that we're talking are mostly about perception.
But I can't see that.
Well, you see what you want to see. Tell me, did you ever see a dinosaur?
No.
Well, did you ever see a pterodactyl?
No.
Well, did you ever want to see a pterodactyl?
I guess not.
Well, that's it. You see what you want to see. And you hear what you want to hear. All you got to do is open your mind along with your eyes.
There was one moment in 1976 when everything changed. And that's where the problem came. When I went to business school before 1976, I was taught that a good CEO makes a decent rate of return for investors and takes good care of his employees, gives them health care insurance and retirement pensions, and is a good community citizen. Pays taxes, imagine that. Donates money to schools and recreational facilities. The good citizen serves the public interest. I was taught that a good company is a good public servant. And that was being ground down. It was being changed. A guy won the Nobel Prize from the Austrian School of Economics named Hayek in the early 70s. And there was this beginning movement to move away from that idea, but it was capped in 1976 when Milton Friedman won the Nobel Prize in Economics. And Friedman said a lot of things, but the most important thing he said was that the only responsibility, the only goal of business is to maximize shareholder profits, regardless of the social and environmental costs. And it had been building up, this idea along those lines, but he sealed it. And when he got the Nobel Prize, it opened the door for President Reagan and Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher and other world leaders to totally buy into this concept. And since then, every president of the United States, every major leader, Democrat, Republican, conservative, progressive, whatever, have basically bought into this. And all the big corporations have bought into it. And so we've got a system now today that says the only responsibility of business is to maximize profits regardless of the social and environmental costs. To hell with the employees, to hell with the customers, to just maximize profits, to hell with the local communities. And that's a perception. But it was changed. It occurred, that pivotal moment, and we can turn that around. New Confessions of an Economic Hitman gets into this a little bit. But this next book gets into a lot more. I don't know, it probably won't be out for another year or two. But the New Confessions gets into this by talking about what Milton Friedman's idea created was something I call a death economy.
Mm-hmm.
An economy that's based on killing people, warfare, or the threat of it, and on ravaging the earth, destroying the earth, killing the earth, destroying the very resources upon which the economy depends. Today we have an economy that's consuming itself and killing itself and going into extinction.
Exactly. That's my whole problem.
And I go into some details in the new Confessions of the Economic Hitman about how we need to move into a life economy, and then each of us can participate. And a life economy is based on cleaning up pollution, regenerating destroyed environments, and using new technologies that recycle or that use the sun and the air. Solar energy is at a very primitive stage. It's making huge progress, but 10 years from now, we're going to look back at these days and say, boy, that was primitive stuff. So we need to create a new system. I call it an economic system, but it's economic and it's political and it's social. It's a life economy that's based on creating an economic system that is itself a renewable resource. We're in the process of making that happen. And we just need to move a little faster and harder down that road. And we need to keep constantly hammering home this new perception that the business of business is not to maximize profits. It's to pay a decent rate of return to investors and then invest in things that will create a life economy.
Basically, what you're saying is to put the heart back in business rather than just maximizing the bottom line. And you know, you can do fine on a 2% return instead of a 12% return, especially if it's going to ensure a better future for your progeny.
Right. And that was what in business school we called, back when I was in business school, blue chip stocks, General Motors, General Electric, the generals, you know, a lot of big companies that would pay 2-4% above inflation. Regularly, you could count on that. And you weren't going to make any windfall profits, but if you invested money when you were young and you kept investing money a little bit every year, by the time you got ready to retire, you'd have a decent retirement. And that's a great concept. But also, the other side of that concept is for the companies to invest that money into things that are creating a life economy, that are serving a public interest rather than serving a death economy.
You know, when you talk about return on investment, that whole economic concept is based on my background's in psychology. We call it the zero-sum game. So if you're getting a positive return on your investment, somebody else is losing. It's a win-lose situation. On whose back are we supposed to be reaping these dividends?
Well, that's an old concept. It doesn't have to be. So imagine if you were investing in a company that's taking all the oil that's been leaked at every oil production site in the world and most every gas station in the world, and filtering it in a way that we could reuse that oil, or a company that's creating energy out of air, which seems like a true possibility these days. In fact, it's being done.
The company still has employees that are driving cars to work in commuter culture. The infrastructure that needs to be built is still relying on metals, which need to be mined from the earth.
The metals don't need to be mined. We've got it. We've got enough of them. They're already here.
So why are we losing our headwaters up in the Amazon if they're already here?
Because it appears to be cheaper to mine than to recycle. But it doesn't have to be that way. And, you know, last year was the first year in U.S. history where more electricity was installed, the production facilities for electricity that were solar than were fossil fuels. I think that's huge progress.
And solar panels are extremely extractive and rely on slave labor. That's what I'm talking about, the win-lose situation.
You mean you think people that make solar panels and getting paid for it are losing?
I think the miners down in the global south are the ones that are losing.
Yeah, but most of the stuff we don't need to mine. We've already got it. We just need to recycle it. Are there obstacles? Yes. Can we always find a reason not to do it? But
I would love to live in a world where the only way you could earn money was by cleaning up somebody else's mess. I would like to live in a world where people do not get paid for sharing their gifts, that the joy of doing so is payment enough.
And I think that's part of the life economy. That's where we need to go. And there's no reason why we can't go there.
That we're not.
I think we are. I really do. I think we've made huge progress in that direction. I see this as I travel around the world. I see it as I speak in colleges. 12 years ago, when I spoke in colleges, MBA programs, for example, and I'd ask the students there what their goals were, it was always power and money. But I don't hear that anymore. Now I hear, I want to create a world that my kids are going to want to grow up in. I want to get out there and take jobs that will enhance this world. And I hear that in China. I spoke at an MBA conference in China recently. Heard that there too. I think people are waking up. Now, do people know how to do this? Not entirely, but there's a lot of progress being made in these areas. I'm encouraged by this. Will we do it? I don't know. But I think that it is in the process. The will is there on the part of some people. And yes, there's a setback too. But what's the alternative? I mean, do you want a world without what we've got today, without electricity? Do you want not to be able to communicate with people across the planet like we can do today? I don't want that. I think it's marvelous that we can do these things. And we've got to be careful how we do them and how we use them, yes. But the fact is, we are a global community today. There's no getting around that. I mean, we may go back to the Stone Ages, but I hope we can instead move into something which really, I think, would be part of the human evolutionary process, moving into a higher consciousness that knows how to deal with these things. It's a lot more fun to believe that we can do it than to believe that we can't.
You know, without the electric, they're screwed. Enough to give them a tood. Imagine their mood when they run out of food. It's going to get ugly, dude. Hee-haw.
That left you speechless, huh?
Yeah. I want to tie it back to what are you doing in the shamanic world to make this happen and as a tool towards these ends.
Yeah, well, that's it. Shamanism teaches us that the world is as you dream it. And we have had a dream of big profits, huge material success. We've had a dream that there's a pie, and if I take a big piece, you get a smaller piece. This has been the dream that we've had. But that's not the only dream there is. And shamanism teaches us that all we got to do is change that perception, that we can turn that perception of the goal of business is to maximize profits. We can turn that around and say, no, the goal of business is to serve a public interest. And businesses have to figure out how to do that. And we're only going to support the ones that do. And to make that dream happen, what each of us has to do, what each of your listeners has to do is go online. I meet with so many corporate executives. I speak at a lot of big conferences. In the last 2-3 months, I've been at 4 big conferences. I'm going to one in St. Petersburg, Russia next week, and then to Kazakhstan, a huge economic conference in Kazakhstan. And, you know, there's so many executives that tell me they want to create a better world for their children and grandchildren. But they're afraid that if they do what they think they need to do, they'll lose 0.5% of market share and their main stockholders will fire them because their main stockholders are bought into this concept of maximizing profits. And if their main stockholders fire them, they'll replace them with a CEO who only cares about market share. And so what they say is, get out there and get my customers to send emails that I can then pass on to our stockholders. So if every one of your listeners picks a company, I don't care whether it's Monsanto, which is the big villain these days, or whether it's Walmart or Nike or Exxon. But if every one of your listeners picks a company and writes them an email once a week, don't make them a bad guy. Say, hey, you know, I want you to be successful. I love your products, Nike, but I'm not going to buy them anymore until you pay your workers in Indonesia a fair wage. And Monsanto, I'm not ever going to buy anything that's made with Monsanto products again until you create a seed that the poorest people in the world can use without having to use toxic fertilizers and insecticides. Otherwise, I'm boycotting your products. And send that email to these companies, but also to all of your social networking circles and ask them to send it to these companies and to all their social networking circles. And if we all do this, these companies are going to change because these CEOs, they remember, they know that Woolworths is no longer. They know that A&P and First National Products is no longer, and Eastern Airlines is no longer, and Kodak is no longer, and Polaroid is no longer, and the Sharper Image is no longer. There's an immense list of companies that are no longer big, powerful companies, Bethlehem Steel, ITT, companies that were extremely powerful, but because they didn't do what their customers wanted or they made lousy management decisions, they are no longer. And that's powerful. And let's not forget that when I was in college, there was apartheid in South Africa and horribly polluted rivers in the United States, and women couldn't get a job in the executive office in any company, basically, and neither could minorities. And that's all changed because of consumer movements. And you know what? That's a blink in history. My lifetime is a blink in history, but it's happening. And we got to keep pushing it harder and harder and harder. And I think we're on the cusp of a major consciousness revolution. We've just got to keep pushing to make it happen.
You don't think the 6th mass extinction is going to catch up with us first?
No, I hope not. But it will if we sit back and say it will. If that's your dream.
No, I'm not even putting it in the future tense. I'm looking at oceans with 95% of edible fish gone. I'm looking at the death of the Great Barrier Reef. I'm looking at a blue ocean event in the Arctic.
Yeah.
These things are already now. They're not right out in the future somewhere.
Right. And in 1773, the colonists in America looked out and they said, we can't possibly fight the British. We can't fight the East India Company. Look what's happened in the Spice Islands of Indonesia. Look what's happened in Africa. Look what these people have done. Look what the British Army has done anytime anybody's resisted them. The British are invincible. George Washington stood up before the Continental Congress, and he recalled a time 20 years earlier during the French and Indian War when he'd been at the Battle of the Monongahela in what is now Pennsylvania and seen a huge crack British army under their best general, General Braddock, terribly defeated. General Braddock and most of his men were killed by a handful of Indians and a few Frenchmen. And Washington said, they're not invincible. All we got to do is have a different perception, hide behind trees. And that changed everything. And then Tom Paine and Tom Jefferson and a number of others wrote and spoke out and phrased all of this in very inspirational terms. And it turned the perception around. And that changed everything. And that's what I'm asking for now. That's what I'm calling on now. And that's what I believe is in the process of happening. And we need another Tom Paine for sure. But we've already got the George Washington. We've got plenty of people out there saying, we can turn this thing around. And that's pure shamanism, incidentally. No shaman. I mean, good God, don't go to a shaman and say, hey, I've got a terrible disease. You can't possibly cure me. Because he'll probably say to you, well, if that's the way you feel about it, then I can't.
Yeah, right.
Everywhere I go, you know, people are waking up to the fact that we've got to change. There's a consciousness revolution underway. I think it's the biggest revolution in the history of humanity, bigger than the industrial or the agricultural revolutions. This is a true consciousness revolution where we're really beginning to understand what it means to be human on this planet and what the responsibilities are, what the challenges and the opportunities are as human beings. We're really finally beginning to wake up to that. And, you know, it's a process, but we're moving forward. We are living at the most blessed time in human history. We are facing the greatest challenges and the most powerful opportunities. This is magical. Shamanism is all about magic, and magic has always won out, whether it's the magic of Merlin in the times of King Arthur, or the magic of the word that Kennedy spoke when he said, we will put a man on the moon in 10 years, and nobody believed it was possible. He had tremendous criticism. He didn't live to see it, but Armstrong walked on the moon in less than 10 years after he made that statement. Mm-hmm. It seemed like an impossibility, but it wasn't. We're at such a time now where it looks tough. It may be tough, but it's not impossible. And it's a blessed time to be alive and be doing all this. We're doing the service of Mother Earth. She's crying out to us. Her glaciers are melting, her oceans are rising. And as a shaman woman, a Quechua woman in the high Andes of Ecuador one time told one of our groups, she said, you know, we're just like a bunch of fleas. And if we get to be too much of a nuisance, Mother Earth will just shake us off. And she's twitching now, this shaman lady said. And she pointed up at this volcano near her house that I'd been visiting for 20 years at the time. And she said, John, you remember back when there was a big snow cap, a big ice cap on that volcano or glacier, and it's no longer there. Pachamama is twitching. She's showing us that we damn well better change or she's going to shake us off. So the exciting thing is that we have the ability to listen to Pachamama and do something. So let's do it.
All right. I'll give you a high five on that. Thank you very much for taking time out of your very busy life. I do two shows a month. You'll have the early June show.
Great. Have a great day. Keep up your great work, Susan. It's been a pleasure.
Take good care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
The storming brains of men and boys play on and keep the darkness at bay.
That's it for now. You just heard The Glucose That Binds the Lightness and Darkness, a 1997 song by Zimft. Lyrics can be found on the Panina page for Sequitur Perception. The program notes sum up this show better than I ever could. Quote, "Our reality is of dialectics, hot, cold, peace, war, friend, foe, lost, found, dark, light. One side cannot exist without the other. We should appreciate our opponents and embrace their different views, aware always of the small, one-sided part we must play to keep the balance and avoid mediocrity." Unquote. I'm forever grateful for the strength of character John Perkins modeled in turning his back on a life of luxury and privilege to become a whistleblower, and for his generosity in finding the time to speak with me here at Sequitur. Thanks also to the YouTube poster who uploaded the small clip from Harry Nilsson's The Point, in which Oblio meets the Rock Man, to Benjamin the Donkey for his sometimes irreverent but always enlightened commentary, and to Zimft for the Sequitur theme music. Until next time, this is Susan Livingston. Thank you.
and puns. It tells us then that there is no seeking, 'cause what connects us is one.